Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
It's been a difficult book, as you know, because of the perspective of tongue-in-cheek writing, trying to show the futility and vanity of man's philosophy without God. Chapter 11 is only 10 verses. And they follow in the train of thought of chapter 10 in the sense that we have moved now from a very cynical, humanistic level of life into a more traditional kind of stance of a Hebrew wisdom teacher. And verse 11 is going to continue these short, brief maxims about traditional points of wisdom on different aspects of life. Now, I think they're all related together in this theme of teaching young men for governmental service or preparing young men for life. And yet the book has a wider range than that, of course, to all people who will read it. And so it's going to be, again, this Jewish understanding. A Jewish sermon is not 3 points in a poem. A Jewish sermon, to keep people's attention, is like beads on a string. And they jump from subject to subject to subject to subject with no kind of connection whatsoever. And, of course, Coles, or Ecclesiastes, or the professor, is doing that exact same thing here in these last few chapters. Now, in chapter 11, there has been a diversity of opinion on how to look at it. And I want to show you something I think will be very helpful to you as you study the Bible. If you read chapter 11 apart from anybody else telling you what they think it means, we would get a wide variety of opinions. For chapter 11 is very succinct and enigmatic and short and choppy, and really what he's talking about is very hard to pick up unless someone says, have you ever thought it might mean da-da? And once you see, hey, it might mean da-da-da-da, then it fits into line. Now, the older commentators, including the Jewish commentators like Rashi and some of them, understand the first few verses to refer to charity, to sharing your goods, material goods, with other people. More modern commentators have said that doesn't seem to fit into the theology of Coles, because remember he said, live your life up, enjoy your possessions. And so many of the modern commentators seem to think that this is referring to the actual commercial enterprise, on some guidelines for a small businessman, if you please. Now, I think we can't be real dogmatic, because just to read this, you wouldn't get either one of those interpretations out of it. So just realize that when commentators start trying to fit the biblical text into their theory, they usually make it fit too strongly, and what doesn't fit, they cut off. And then they start allegorizing it. I'll give you an example. Verse 6, morning and evening. If you believe that it's talking about charity, most commentators who believe that say morning and evening is talking about your whole life. Give charitably in your youth and through your old age. Well, now, if you read that, it's talking about morning and evening. It's not talking about your whole life. So let's go through it. I will give you both sides, and let's take a vote at the end, okay? I think that's fair enough. Let's just go through it, and I'll give you both opinions. And let's vote, and I think it'll surprise you about how even we'll be divided, okay? Let's read verses 1 and 2. I think they form a unit first, okay? Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portions to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. Now, the word cast is really not like, some people say it's like sowing seeds, but that's not the Hebrew word at all. The Hebrew word is the word send away. Send away or throw away. So cast, like casting seeds or sowing seeds, not anything to do with this. So send away your bread on the water. Now, when I first read bread on the water, I don't know if you all go out and feed the ducks with your kids, but we go feed the ducks a lot, and the bread just gets all mushy and falls apart. And I was thinking of our kind of bread, loaves, you know, cut in little slices, but these are Hebrew things of bread. They look like frisbees, thick frisbees, you know, round, hard bread, and it would float for a period of time. So that's what we're thinking about, is these long, flat loaves. Then cast your loaves upon the water, and you will find it after many days. Now, the word "will find" in Hebrew is the word "recover." Now, the implication is, one theory, using Proverbs chapter 31, verse 14, which says it, that is the context of the godly woman who brings her bread by ship from afar, those kind of things. Basically, it's referring to divest your money into capital gain, send away on ships with your material goods, and it'll come back to you in profit. They see that kind of thing here. Others see it's referring to charity. And I think if it does refer to charity, we must realize that the motive for giving is not "I'll get back." You don't help people with the view toward "I'll help those who can help me again." That's a rather shabby motive for charity, I think, is so we can recover it again. And yet, we must remember the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, is not totally against giving with some kind of view toward receiving again. You see, that's not totally evil. Especially the book of Proverbs tends to teach that kind of thing. Give and you shall receive is a typical Old Testament biblical kind of a maxim. So we must not attribute too much evil to them in the motive of giving so you'll receive. Now verse 2, I think, amplifies verse 1. It's talking about dividing up your... some people say it's dividing between 7 and 8 ships, so in case a couple are sunk, you've got something to come back. Others say give to as many people as possible. That way, when the bad days come, you'll have some friends to help you. And you see how they're taking this text, it's very succinct, and they're using it either for commerce or for charity. But the biblical text itself just does not say exactly what it's talking about. Now, the word misfortune in verse 2 is really the word evil. And I think that verse 3 is an amplification of the word evil or misfortune in verse 2. Now, the reason it says that there's going to be evil in the world or misfortune in the world and you don't know what's going to happen to you is, and so because of that, verse 3 amplifies that little word in verse 2. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. This is talking about, I think, the fact that you can't change circumstances. Things are going to happen you can't stop. You have no control over the clouds. You have no control when a windstorm comes if it blows the tree to the left or the right. Now, because the Hebrew word for tree here in verse 3 does not necessarily mean tree. It can mean wood or rod. Some have thought that what we have here is a reference to divination. And a good example of that would be Hosea chapter 4, verse 12, which talks about a divining rod. I looked for about an hour for a verse, and I don't know where it is, but I know it's in the Old Testament. It was a king who was planning to go to a battle, and he had arrows in his hand, and he drops the arrows to tell him which way to go to battle or not. Anybody know who that is offhand? I looked for that book all afternoon and couldn't find it. It's the same kind of idea of dropping a piece of wood to find out God's will. So what he's saying is you can't control the circumstances by divination, and you can't control the weather. Or it may just mean you can't control where a tree falls, and you can't determine where the rainstorms come. So it's saying there's evil in the world. You can't control it. You can't know what's going to happen. So spread out your assets, and you'll receive back. Whether it's economics or whether it's charity is debatable. Now, beginning in verse 4, we move into a different kind of context. In verse 4 it says, "He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap." The only way I can think about it, there's two possibilities here. One of them is, don't look for ideal circumstances to start any activity. Like, don't wait till there's absolutely no wind to spray your trees, because you'll never spray your trees here in Lubbock, will you? Don't wait till it's a perfect day. You know, if rain's going to come in the afternoon to fertilize your lawn, because if you wait for it rain in the afternoon, you'll never get your lawn fertilized. What I'm saying is don't wait for the ideal conditions to start something. Start anyway, and then trust God for the result. It also may mean don't be pessimistic. Even though you can't control circumstances, go ahead and trust and sow anyway. Be active anyway. Do good to as many people as possible. Begin your work and see if God's going to bless it. Don't wait to see if God's going to bless it first and then do it, but begin and then see what God's got for you. Now, It's got to be something like that in the context. Now, verse 5, just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of a pregnant woman, you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Now, there's, again, two possibilities here. Many translations, instead of having the word wind, have the word spirit. And that's the same word. It's the word ruah. Ruah means breath, the breath of life, or the breath of animals, or the wind, or spirit. It can mean all kinds of things in the Old Testament. Now, because I think this is the reference that Jesus uses in John 3:8 when he says, the wind bloweth where it listeth, is the reason I think it should be the word wind. Now, either this means that the Spirit of God forms the baby's bones in the mother's womb, and what we have is one example of the mystery of God, or verse 5 is two examples. The wind blows where it wants to. You don't know where it's going, you don't know where it's coming from. And also, babies are formed in the womb in a way that you don't understand and don't know. So it's either two examples or one example of the fact that although you don't know how it works, God's in control and he is working things out in accordance with his will. Now, again, this last little thing, my translation has the two main verbs translated just alike. You do not know, the first part of verse 5, and you do not know, the last part of verse 5. But they are different tenses in Hebrew. The first one should be, you do not know. But the last one, if you'll please add to your translation, two little words. So you do not and will not know the activity of God. It's a special tense in Hebrew that says you don't know now and you're not going to know in the future. It's saying that God is sovereign. Now, this is the common theme throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Over and over, he said, you can't understand God. God's in control and we can trust him and love him, but you can't understand what God's about. Now, he has said that at least 5 times in this few chapters. So, and again, God who makes all things. This book has hit the sovereignty of God over and over and over again. Life's a gift of God. Health's a gift of God. Everything's a gift of God. To Coley. So, here's two major themes. You can't know what God's doing, but God's in control. And that's very important, this book. You can't understand why the sinner is in the place of prosperity and honor, and the righteous man is sometimes in the place of poverty and rejection. You can't understand why sometimes things don't work out the way we think they should, but God's in control. And that's very important to catch this author. Now, number 6. By the way, I have listed verse 5, unknown and variable. And that's just a practical way of saying, though we don't understand it, that we can't plan on something happening. There are unknowns and variables in every circumstance in life, but God is in control of even the unknown. Now, verse 6, sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether the morning or the evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. Now, again, the word morning and evening, if you take it to be charity, some see morning and evening as representing a person's whole life, but this is called allegorizing Scripture. Now, I think that Scripture is sometimes written to be allegorized, and we'll see some of that in chapter 12. But this here seems to me to referring to reaping, I mean to sowing. And the little Hebrew word that says, sow in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, a better English translation than do not be idle in the evening is do not be idle until the evening. It's talking about sowing from sunup till sundown and not stopping. It's not talking about sowing in the morning and then sowing again in the evening. It's talking about continue to sow all day. For you don't know if the seeds are going to make it that are sown early or late. So it's talking about activity of life. He's author of the book said, things are worth nothing. Everything's for the birds. Nothing's going to work out. We can't know nothing. Everything's bad. But now he's saying, look, don't let this attitude that humanly speaking we can't know, and don't let this attitude that things are just here today and gone tomorrow, and don't let this attitude that we can't control our own human situation thwart you from working and being active. Don't become cynical, if you please, okay? He's saying, so, be active, do things, okay? Now, let's see. I have listed 2 Corinthians 9:6 as a possible cross-reference that says something like, he who sows sparingly will reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will reap bountifully. And that's kind of what this is saying here. If you sow a whole bunch, you're going to reap some. You don't know, you may reap a tremendous amount. So sow, work, be active, don't be discouraged, don't give up. Now, my translation has verses 1 through 6 as one paragraph. It is very important how your translation sees this paragraph division, because when it shows a paragraph division, it means that it sees one general theme in that paragraph. Now, my translation saw one general theme between verse 1 and verse 6. I don't really see that theme there. And I don't know where the paragraph division should come, but it seems to me that we need to break it up a little smaller chunks than that. Does anybody here have a Bible that breaks the paragraph different than 1 through 6? All translations have 1 through 6 of the paragraph. 1 through 3? I like that a lot better. Okay, I like that a lot better. I think that's... What translation is that, Jerry? Living Bible? Yeah, I like that better. Sure do. Now, let's look at verse 7. Verse 7 and 8 at least are a context. Light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Now, light is pleasant, it's good to your eyes. Looking at Psalms 49:19 and many other passages, it seems that to see the sun, to be in the light, to live in the light, to enjoy the light, is a reference to life. And a reference to darkness or days of darkness seems to be a reference to death and Sheol. So what we have here, now he said, he's mentioned before that I'd rather be a miscarriage than have a life like this or that. So, in a sense, his mood is changing. He's coming to the end of his writing now. He's maturing his thought. He was a little pessimistic at first. He's reevaluating life some. He was looking at life from a human point of view at first. Now he's looking at life by putting God, a sovereign God, into the picture. And as he was ready to die over here because God wasn't in the picture, now he's saying, live, rejoice, enjoy life. Because, you see, he's moved from the early chapters where God was not involved in man's situation to these later chapters where God is the giver of life, you see. Now, so I think that we're talking about death and life here. But you see what I'm doing? Do you see that the Bible doesn't say that specifically? Do you see that I'm getting that from the context of the book as well as the whole context of the passage? The Bible simply says, light is pleasant, it is good to the eyes to see the sun. Now, my own personal understanding of what this thing is trying to say says that it's saying life is better than death because of the next verse. The next verse says this, indeed, if a man should live many years. Now, living many years was a Hebrew sign of the blessings of God. Old men are revered in the East. Is that true? Age is revered, not youth, age. Now, let him rejoice in them all. Now, This theme to rejoice is repeated in verse 9. And this is a new element in Kohelet or Ecclesiastes or the professor. He has said, boy, it's all for the bird. It's all a big bag of worms. I don't have to do with it. Now he's saying, enjoy life. Rejoice. Make the best of what you've got. There is good in life. There is enjoyment here. God's in control. Rejoice. So, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Now, I think the days of darkness there refers to death, refers to Sheol, refers to the shadowy existence in another world. You see, the book of Ecclesiastes does not really see an afterlife except vaguely in chapter 12. Even when it says there's going to be, the spirit goes back to God in chapter 12, it understands nothing of where the spirit goes, what the spirit's going to be like, if it's going to be joyous or happy. These are full of revelations that come in books of Daniel, and especially in the New Testament, in some of the Psalms of David. So this man, if you please, has partial blindness. He doesn't see the whole truth. Matter of fact, none of the Old Testament writers see the whole truth. They look through veils at life. You just see some of it. So, I think that first is Sheol. Now notice this last little phrase in verse 8. Everything that is to come will be futility or vanity. He has said over and over and over and over and over and over and over again that everything in this life is vain. Doesn't last. Man's helpless. Man's transitory. Especially if you look at life without God. Now, what he's saying right here is not only is life vanity and nothing and futility, but death is vanity and futility and nothingness. You see that? Everything that is to come will be futility. So he's hitting this theme again that if there's no God, things are bad. Not only bad here, but bad in the future. So I think it's very important that you see that added element there in verse 8. Now, verse 9, rejoice. Again, don't be down. Don't be discouraged. Yes, things are bad. Yes, you can't know exactly what God's doing. Yes, you don't know how it's all going to work out. But be active. Don't give up. Enjoy life. That's what he's saying. Young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood. Now, I think, again, the target group that Kolis is writing to is young men of the middle class. I'll tell you why. Poor peasants would not be reading, first of all. Well, they probably couldn't read, and number two, they wouldn't be reading books on philosophy and wisdom. So these are young men, middle class, upper middle class, who are going to go into the government service or want to know how to live. This was, if you please, the college curriculum on the philosophy of life, these wisdom writers. And so basically, his target group is young men. But you can tell from verse 8 that it includes those who live a long time. So it's wider than that, but the target group is young men, especially based on chapter 10. Now, notice it says that and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Now, the heart and the eyes, to the Hebrew, would be the organs of the most sensual pleasure. Now, many have said, this is saying, man, put your glad rags on and go to town because you're going to die. Live it up. That's not at all what it's saying. The next little phrase shows you that's not what it's saying. When it says, enjoy the days of your youth and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, I think it's saying enjoy the innocent pleasures of life. It's not saying go out and live it up and get drunk, you know, and all that stuff and just have a good old time and throw your money to the wind and forget your friends and, abuse your relatives. It's saying what's good about life, enjoy it. What you've got, enjoy it. But remember, young man, God's going to bring you an account for the way you live. It's saying enjoy the good things of life. But remember, you're going to give an account to God for what you do. That's a good advice. I've asked the best advice I've heard in a long time. Enjoy what's good in the world. But remember, you're going to be called into account the way you live and how you use the things that God's given you. So I like that. Now, this little thing about God will bring you to judgment for all these things. We need to talk about what kind of judgment. From here, many of you have been here every Wednesday night because we've been studying Ecclesiastes, and I want to ask you a question. Is he talking about temporal judgments that come in this life, or is he talking about eternal judgment? What do you think? And why? Okay, Debbie? Okay. Why? And the basis that would be, he sees dimly that there's some hope after life, but he doesn't know what to do about it because he's frustrated that the righteous are crushed and the sinner is elevated, right? That's his whole gripe, that things are upside down. Well, the reason that bothers him is because he hadn't pictured this next life to balance things out, you see. So that's exactly right. I think mostly this is talking about temporal judgment. Put it another way. Sin runs its natural course. Now, you can sin, but you pay a price when you sin. You say, oh, but sin's so much fun. Really, when you think about it, God has made our world in such a way that if you follow His laws and His commandments, you'll have a happy life. Sin is nothing more than man breaking himself on the false values of a fallen world. Sin is not pleasure, really. sin is heartache. Now, it may be fun for the moment, but ultimately it has the seeds of destruction in itself. So I think we reap what we sow. If you live in a way that's apart from the way that God created the world, you're going to pay a price here and now. But I think because of chapter 12, verse 7, that we've got to say we can't rule out eternal judgment, because God is also going to bring man into account one day. The Jewish understanding of the day of the Lord, or eschatological judgment, or Messiah breaking into history. So I think it's mostly temporal. But I think there is an element that you're not sure. God's in control. There is a plan, and you're going to be held accountable to the standard. So I think it's both, but I see most emphasis on the temporal aspect here. Now, verse 10. So remove vexation from your heart. Now, I want to say a word about vexation. Vexation is nothing more than an attitude toward life. Vexation is a way to look at things. I want to give an example. My little daughter came home from vacation Bible school, mad as she could be, because she only got two cookies. I said, "Now, Michelle, what do you want, Michelle?" "I want three cookies." I said, "Well, honey, have you ever thought that two is one more than one?" Now, you see, we were looking at the same thing, but she was mad because she didn't have three, and I was trying to tell her, "Y'all be happy you had one more than one." Now, the situation was the same, but it was the attitude that we were looking at the same problem. Now, vexation of spirit is nothing more than looking at the same set of circumstances in a gripey, ungodly, humanistic attitude. That's exactly why we have to have our minds renewed by the Spirit of Christ, so that we can see, even in bad circumstances, the hand of God by faith. Vexation is taking Coley at his word and not realizing he's tongue-in-cheek. I remember one time when I first came here, and y'all weren't really used to my humor. Some of you I said some things to that I meant to be sarcastic, in the sense that it was ironical. I was saying something very strong so you would know that I wasn't meaning that at all. But some of your mouth fell open because you weren't used to my kind of humor. And you said, "You see, I meant it one way, and you took it exactly opposite. Because I was hoping you'd turn it upside down, and you took it just what I said." Now, that's what happens to people if they read the book of Ecclesiastes and not used to what he's writing. They read what he says and think this is divinely inspired, and they never realize he's writing tongue-in-cheek, or he's writing it so as to turn it upside down to get the true meaning. Now, put away pain from your body. Now, the word pain, I don't know why they put that there. It's the word evil again. Put away evil from your body. Because of verses, because of translations of this in different languages, like the Septuagint, the Greek translation, because of Jerome's translation, the Latin, the words that Jerome used and the words that the writers of the Septuagint used show that they understood this passage to refer to moral evil. Now, I think it refers to both. I think it refers to physical evil and moral evil. What he's saying is, friends, if you can ride in a new Buick, don't go in a Volkswagen. I mean, if you have a choice in a Volkswagen and a Buick, for goodness sake, take the Buick. Don't be dumb. You know, it's totally opposite from the monastic way of life, asceticism. They used to go out and they would buy pig skin. But to show they really loved God, they would leave the hairs on it and turn the hairs on the inside. That's kind of dumb. And then they would brag because, "Boy, I'm so miserable." You know, Martin Luther one time almost froze in his cell because he was showing how much he loved God by not using cover. Well, to me, Cody is saying, don't be dumb. If you got shoes, wear them. If you got socks and shoes, wear socks and shoes. And if you only have shoes, thank God for it and wear the shoes. But if you got two ways to go, one's comfortable, one's uncomfortable, take the comfortable one. That's what he's saying. Now, the other side of that is this moral evil thing. If there's two ways to go, and one of them's evil, one of them's kind of shady, and one of them you know will be better, take the one that's better. Don't let evil attach itself to you, okay? Keep evil from your body, because childhood, now this little word, mine has the prime of life. Does yours have the prime of life at the childhood in the last verse? This is a beautiful little Hebrew phrase. Hebrew is an ancient language, doesn't have many adjectives. Matter of fact, Hebrew has no adjectives. If you want to talk about somebody who's ugly, you call them the son of ugliness. If you want somebody smart, it'd be the son of wisdom. Now, if you want to talk about someone in the prime of life, the Hebrew, literal Hebrew phrase for this is the days of black hair. That's good, isn't it? Once it turns color, it's bad news, Jimmy. Over the hill, see? Hair color change. Anyway, the days of black hair would be the prime of life, okay? Now, I think that mine has two there. It has because of childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. But really, some translations have because childhood, which is the days of black hair, are fleeting. I think probably he's talking about young, prime of life really probably shouldn't be there. It's the days of youth, period. Now, but remember that a Hebrew guy could be called a youth from, say, 50 down, 40 down for sure. So we're not talking about 20 years old. We're talking about 40 down as being the days of black hair or something like that. And he's saying they're gone. They're not going to last. Man, they're gone just like that. So don't put all your eggs in the basket of youth because you ain't going to be youth long. It's going to pass away. Okay. Let's talk about this some because this thing is really it just doesn't help us interpret it a whole lot. How many of you think these first few verses are talking about commercial trade and business maxims and proverbs for how to run your business? Okay, how many of you think it's talking about charity and giving things away? Okay, would y'all help me by sharing me why you voted one way or the other? Can you tell me, Jamie? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we could almost paraphrase it, don't put all your eggs in one basket, couldn't we? Okay, and that's very good. And the principle you use to do that is, the overarching context of the chapter before, and I like that. Uh-huh. Yeah, his pearls on a string, right? Right. Okay, I agree with that. Who that sees it as charity? Why did you come to that? Vale, why did you come to that? I happen to see your hand. Okay. What do y'all see in verse 3 about the tree falling and all? What does that say to you? Excuse me? Yeah, we can't control a whole bunch, can we? I mean, you can't stop a waterfall. Exactly. Except the things you can't change. And then here again, you have to understand Coley's writing. He's not saying accept the things you can't change in blind faith, is he? He's saying accept the things you can't change knowing that God's in control. Now see how different that is from a cynical point of life that says, well, I can't change it, might as well join it, right? No, I don't. It's saying, I don't understand it and I can't change it and I feel helpless and I know I'm not going to be here long, but I know there's a God in control. You see how Coley is writing? He's picking at man from man's own level. He's standing eyeball to eyeball with the cynic and he's saying, this is the way it is, isn't it? God's saying, yeah. And then Coley is saying, but look how miserable life is if what you say is all there is. There is something higher. And you see how he writes? He writes tongue in cheek. You miss that? That's why this book is a proof text for Jehovah Witnesses. They take it literal, right across the board. And by taking it literal, they get people are dead and that's all. You don't remember nothing, no happiness. So they just axe heaven right off. You see what they're doing? They're taking it literal. They're missing the tongue-in-cheek. They missed the sarcasm and thought I was really biting them instead of playing with them. Okay. Comments? Questions? Okay. you would base your understanding there from the whole context of biblical revelation instead of the previous chapter. Yeah. Okay. Possibly in our view, New Testament view of sowing, you know, that verse I've quoted, 2 Corinthians 9:6, is, you know, yeah. But do you see how the Hebrew doesn't say either one? Hebrew is very short, succinct, just says, sow a lot and you'll be better off. You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Cast your bread upon the water, it'll come back to you. Maybe soggy, it'll come back to you. So, we just don't know exactly what it's talking about. What here, if you had to pick out one thing that's meaningful to you, which one do you pick out? What would you pick out? Yes, James. Okay. Be active. You can't control things. You don't know what's going to happen, but be active. Okay? A lot of folks do. Yeah. It's called pie in the sky religion. It is. That's right. I get it a lot when we ask somebody to do something. They say, let me pray about it. I'm all for prayer, but 6 months? Jennifer, do you have your hand up, girl? Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah, that's very good. Somebody else? Yeah? Mm-hmm. All right. Don't live for today, maybe live for tomorrow. You know, take into account you won't always be here. And so build a wider base. Okay. Somebody else? Okay, one more chapter, and chapter 12 has some very strong conclusions, this whole book. Again, this book must be taken in context. You can't interpret this book, just pull a verse here and a verse there. This book cannot be done that way. This book must be read in context, and this book must be understood as being tongue-in-cheek. Else, this book is radically opposed to everything else that the Bible teaches. So, it's got to be interpreted that way.